from York University. He's currently on sabbatical at PI, so you may have seen him around. If you haven't, here's your opportunity, I guess. He got his PhD from Cambridge, then did postdocs at University of Toronto and Florida State University. And as I said, now he's at York University as a faculty in the math department there. And he works on kind of statistical physics, self-avoiding walks, and so we'll hear some about that today.
Thank you, Daniel, and thanks for the opportunity to speak here. I'm going to talk about Monte Carlo, and while I talk, I want you to keep in mind that it's a method of last resort. It's something you do after you've done everything else that you could do. Right? You first try to prove theorems about something, and then perhaps to solve a better part of it. But in the end, if all fails, then you turn to Monte Carlo. And so this is something I don't do all the time. Maybe 30% of my time I've spent on Monte Carlo over the last 20 years or so are thinking about it. And this would be a very lightweight rendition of what we've done. So here's a good place to start. This paper appeared on the archive in the beginning of September 2012, so a couple of months ago. And the writing is a bit small, but you can at least see the title. The title says non-associative Ramsey theory and then the amenability of Thompson's group. Amenability of a group, let me give you the definition, and then you can forget it immediately what the definition was, because we'll use a different definition for it. The definition is a group is amenable, so an abstract group is amenable, if it has, so if there exists, a left invariant finitely additive probability measure on it. Right? So that is basically what the formal definition is. It's been shown to be equivalent to a lot of other statements, and we'll see one later on. What's interesting about this paper, though, is a comment that appears towards the end of September by the author. The author is Justin Moore. He's a good mathematician, but he put up this comment on this paper about a month after he submitted it to the archive. And the error was pointed out by a man called Akhmedov. And if you trace back a bit on the web what happened here, you'll see that in 2010 already, a question was asked on this website, Math Overflow, and you can do the question yourself, but it has to do with what's its status? Is F amenable or is it not? Here is one answer given. So Akhmedov pointed out an error in the paper by Moore. And here, Akhmedov's paper, he tried to prove the opposite, that F is not amenable, also had a counterexample to it. And so Akhmedov's paper is correct, except for a lemma. And Shevardnadze's paper has lemma 5, which is wrong. So we have three wrong lemmas in three papers. And so what would you take from this? Well, you know, naively I would say mathematicians should stop proving lemmas and just stick to theorems, right? It's the lemmas always have a problem, it seems. But there's actually a bit more. This is what you should take from it. There's a 12-12 vote, 12 in favor and 12 against. Now, what this means to me is that there is no intuition. Right? There's no natural intuition. People don't know if this group is amenable or not. Some people think that it's amenable and they have their reasons, and other people think the opposite. And this is why the attempts to prove it amenable or not have failed over the last couple of years. So let me just tell you a little bit more about what I'm talking about. So you're going to look at the finitely presented group G. It has a bunch of generators, A, B, and so on, and a couple of relators on those generators. And so here's a typical example. So this would be the abelian group on two generators. So two generators, A and B, and then one relator, which is just a commutation of A and B. In this kind of group, there's an empty word, E. That's the identity of the group, right? The relator is equal to the identity, right? So in the abelian group, the commutator of A and B would be the identity. So I'm going to call a word trivial if it's equivalent to the identity. And there are lots of other trivial words. So here's another trivial word in the abelian group. Right? I'm going to define the set Sn. So freely reduced trivial words of length n. By freely reduced, I simply mean that a letter, so a generator, A, would not be followed by its inverse immediately. Right? So you can't have A inverse of A or inverse of A times A in a string, so in a word in this group. So Sn would be the set of all these freely reduced trivial words of length n. I'm going to define the cogrowth. The cogrowth, the exponential rate at which the set Sn grows, right, the cardinality of the set. And here's the theorem. So the cogrowth is 2m minus 1 if and only if G is amenable. So in the abelian group, which we know is amenable, the cogrowth would be equal to 3. Right? And if you take the generating function of Sn, then its dominant singularity will be at a third on the real axis. So that's what you should remember. Remember, one third, if you have two generators, that means it is amenable. If G is amenable, then you have this, the cardinality of Sn grows at this rate. And so proving that the group is amenable or not would mean that you have to determine the growth rate of Sn. Okay. Now, clearly reduced trivial words are reduced paths in Zn, or in Zd in this case. And you can easily assign directions to the letters in the group or the generators and make polygons, for example, like these. So these are two trivial words in the abelian group. And so we have to count lattice paths and lattice polygons in order to find out if the group is amenable or not. Okay, so just to show you, this is Thompson's group on two generators, one of his representations. You can also look at other representations of the group on four and five generators in this case, and in the study we've done, we've looked at all of these. Okay. So lattice paths and lattice polygons. And so this brings me to a very old problem in polymer physics, which is the problem of polymer entropy. So you have a polymer molecule, and it has many conformations. And the problem is determine the entropic, or the conformational entropy of this polymer. So count the number of states, the density of states. So models that were introduced self-avoiding walks and polygons, and I'm going to focus on these. And here is a typical self-avoiding walk. Right? So you start at the origin, and you step away in the lattice, up, down, left, or right, and you're conditioned to be not intersecting yourself. Right? And Cn, I will define to be the number of self-avoiding walks of length n, and this is the most basic quantity in this game. So what you want to do really is to determine Cn, and if you could, you would have solved the problem. So here's the prototype problem. So you start at the origin. At first, you have four choices for the first step, and you choose one of those, and you know that C1 is 4, right? For the second step, you have three choices, and so you have 12 of length 2. Then you have three choices for the third step. Now it's 36. 2 for the next step, but C4 is 100, right? Not 2 times 36, because you can't come back to the origin. And so here you go, and you step out, eventually get to C13, C20, and so on. What is hard about this problem? So this is what's hard. It's non-Markovian. And it's non-Markovian in a very bad way. So first of all, every step you give is conditioned on your entire past history, right, where you've been. But not only that, the next step you give is conditioned on where you're going to. Right? So you can't give a red step at this point. If you give a red step, you can't get to X, where you may have wanted to go. Right? So you have to step with probability 1 onto the blue edge. If it was there, then the probability switches. And in general, if you want to compute the probabilities on your next step in this problem, you have to know the future history of all the walks going out from where you are, avoiding your past, right? So it's a very difficult thing to do. And so the problem is not only conditioned on the past, it's also conditioned on the future. Right? So it's non-Markovian in a very fundamental way. This is what makes this a hard problem. So here's the most basic question, what is CN? Well, you know, there's an answer. So C71 is known. This is an amazing numerical result. Requiring really, really clever programming techniques to get. This was done by Ivan Jensen in 2004. You can probably get one or two more terms now, but of course, it doesn't matter. What you really need is a better algorithm. He's using a method called the finite lattice method, which is a souped up transfer matrix method. This is in 2D. That's right. Well, this is an exact enumeration. This is counting them all up to 721. No. This is all the walks, just with uniform weight. So every walk is weight one. Will have to end. Yeah, they'll be trapped. That's right. So it's all the conformations, every single conformation. So. Getting a CN is hard, so you think about, well, maybe we should get approximate estimates, and this is where Monte Carlo comes in. So what is the large N behavior? So here is a very easy argument for getting the large N behavior of CN. So you take a walk from the origin of length N, there are CN choices for it, right? You take another walk of length M, and you see you have CM choices for it. Right? And you glue them together where the two bullets are. Glue them together, move them, and glue them together into a new walk, and you get a state like this. Now, you get all these walks of length Cn plus M, plus a whole bunch of others where there are intersections between the two halves, right? So this implies that Cn is submultiplicative. If you have a submultiplicative function like that, a consequence is that this limit exists, and mu is called the growth constant of walks. Now, it reminds you a bit of that co-growth of the group that I pointed out at the beginning. And so if you know this limit exists, then CN grows exponentially fast. And then you go to physics, you do a bunch of scaling arguments, and you notice that CN most likely grows as a power n to the gamma minus 1 times an exponential. And gamma has an exact value coming out of conformal field theory. It's 43 over 32. That's exact in 2D. In three dimensions, it is a bit smaller than that. In four dimensions, it takes the mean field value, then gamma is 1. Right? So Monte Carlo. We're going to do Monte Carlo on this problem. You should think of Monte Carlo as having two components. The first is an elementary move, so something you do. And the second is a set of rules for implementing that elementary move. So you should think of these as separate. Right? You can have an elementary move, which you can implement with many different kinds of rules. One of the rules that you should know about is the Metropolis algorithm. But I'm not going to talk about it, but towards the end, I'll show you one calculation done with Metropolis sampling. Here is Monte Carlo methods for the self-avoiding walk over the last, I guess, 50 years or 60 years. It started already in 1957. I'm going to talk mostly about one, the first one. I'm also going to point out the last three to you because they are results of the first one in many ways. The others are all very interesting algorithms and ingenious in many ways. Using many different kinds of elementary moves and then, of course, Metropolis. Metropolis algorithms for the most part in the middle set, the BFACF scanning method and so on, are more Metropolis style in nature. Okay. So who is Rosenbluth? So here is a picture of Rosenbluth. I was trying to hunt down a picture of Arianna Rosenbluth as well, but I can't. Now, Rosenbluth was alive, I believe, until 2007. He and his wife, Arianna, were co-authors on the Metropolis paper, Metropolis sampling paper in 1953. A couple of years later, I think 2 years later, they published another paper as a pair, which described this Rosenbluth algorithm for sampling paths. as I said, you know, he was at Los Alamos. He was recruited by Edward Teller. He was a real cold warrior, involved in atomic weapon development and so on. But in 1957, they used an idea of Hammersley and Morton to design an algorithm for sampling self-avoiding walks. And so this is how the algorithm works. You start at the origin and you notice there are four steps you can give initially. So you pick one of them, and the probability of picking one of them is a quarter, right? The second step you pick, probability is a third, right? Because you have three choices. So you get that state with probability 1/12, right? And that one with probability 1/36. This one you get with probability 1/72. Now, if you remember, I told you there are 100 states of length 4, right? So you can see there's some non-uniformity creeping in here, and that the algorithm finally will not sample uniformly from the set of walks of length n. It will have some other distribution. For 5, it's 1/216, and so on. And by TP20, you have 1.3 billion or something like that, 1.4 billion. Probability is 1 in 1.4 billion to get any state, right? To get this state, for example. So here is the algorithm. You create walks by sampling from the origin. Each step is chosen uniformly from those available. You don't care about the future, in other words, you just care about the next step. Assign a weight to each step, and the weight will just be the inverse of the probability you've been computing all along. Now, the good thing is you compute this probability locally, right? It's very cheap to compute. And so to update your weight each time you step is a very easy calculation. If the walk is trapped, you assign weight 0, you throw away the state, you start again. And you're going to compute the average weight. Now, the average weight is the probability of getting what times the weight of the walk. That's the sum over 1. And so if you look at the average weight of states of length n, you see that must be Cn. And so just computing the average weight gives you an estimator for the number of walks. This is called the Rosenbluth counting theorem, and I've implemented it. So this was just done on my laptop, so the graphics are not that good. But what I want you to notice is that very frequently you stop. You trap yourself. And once you trap yourself, you have to reject your state and start again for a new walk. Now, this is not a problem when the walks are short, but it becomes a problem around n equal to 80, when you have 80 steps. Another thing which becomes a problem with 80 steps is that the weights disperse over many orders of magnitude. So one weight may be 10,000 times the size of another weight, and you want to take averages of these things, right? So this skews your statistics, and the algorithm essentially fails. But this is the sort of data you get out. This is a very short walk, up to 10 edges, just as an illustration. You can already see the at 9 and 10, 8, 9, and 10, you're starting to lose some walks. And this proportion grows up to 80% or 90% by the time you get to 80 or 90. Right? So you throw away most of the walks you start because eventually they trap. In 2D and 3D, it's a bit better. So the weights disperse. That is the other problem. So here's what you can do about it. You can prune them. If a state has a weight which is too small, and by too small I mean it is less than the average weight you've computed so far, then you prune it. You just cut it, throw it away, and on the default, if you don't throw it away, you just inflate that weight. You made it a bit bigger, right? So probability P, throw away your state, and with the default probability, you inflate the weight. You make it a bit bigger, bring it a bit closer to that average. Or you enrich. If your weight is too big, you replace your current state by two copies of itself. You reduce the weight by the number of copies you have created, and you grow each independently into the future, right? And so you add this to your set of sampled walks. And so you implement this recursively, you do this at every step, and you get the Fermi algorithm, and so your sampling now looks like this. You can see the first half of that walk is static. That is a state that's being enriched. And the pieces that are growing are pieces of the walk where it samples ahead, trying to find states of high weight, which it can then enrich itself, right? So it's looking for these states of high weight in order to enrich your sample with them. And it does this automatically. But we are interested in this, polygons, right? You don't have an endpoint. And so you need different You don't need different elementary moves, right? So here is one elementary move. You have a piece of a polygon there on the left, and it makes a right angle. And that right angle, you can think there's a little plaquette sitting there. And what you're going to do is you're just going to move the two edges over the plaquette, moving the state on the left to the right. So this is just a piece of a polygon. This is called the neutral move because it does not change the length of the polygon. Here's another move. This is a positive or negative move. On the left, you have a plaquette. It's incident on your piece of polygon. And instead of going along this lower boundary, you go around the upper part of the plaquette and you get the state on the right-hand side. That's called a positive move. And of course, every positive move can be inverted into a negative move. You could go from the right to the left here. So these are elementary moves called the BFACF moves, introduced in the 1980s by two different sets of authors in two different years, right? So they both used this to sample polygons, lattice polygons, and they used essentially a Metropolis-style implementation for these. So this is what your polygon looks like. So here's a polygon, and I mark all the places where you can do these moves with the appropriate colors. So blue means you can do a positive move, red a negative move, and then the green would be your neutral move. You should think of these plaquettes sitting around the polygon as sort of an atmosphere for it. They're always there, right, in this move, and you can always do things at do the walk at this move. And so there are six places where you can do a positive move that I will call the positive atmosphere of this polygon. Right? So it has size six, and then A minus three and A zero is three. So let us just do sampling quickly. So A plus is four in this case. You pick one of them, the probability is 1/4, right? 1/A+. And you do another one. In this case, In this case, you have four places where you can do a positive move. Six places where you can do a positive move. You do one of them, and your next state comes up with probability 1/4 × 6. And so you sample ahead as you go along. And each time in this implementation, I'm not going to do neutral moves or positive moves. I'll never do a negative move. I'll just grow this polygon and sometimes keep it the same size. And so you keep on going. And you get a sequence of states sampled by positive and neutral moves. So we should know something about these moves. Now, one thing you can prove fairly easy is that these moves are irreducible in the square lattice. So if you start at this square polygon, you can grow any other polygon from it. It's a very easy thing to do. In 3D, it's harder. In 3D, it's harder because you have knotting, right? And these moves don't unknot a knotted polygon. But there's a nice theorem, my own theorem, I should say. It's a nice theorem, therefore, which says that the irreducible classes of these moves in 3D coincide with the knot types of these polygons, right? So if you think of these polygons as knots in 3 space, each of those knotted classes define a set of knotted polygons of the same knot type, and these moves connect any two states in that set. So here is the algorithm we're going to use. I'm going to start with the root polygon, which you can think of as the little square, and I'll call that my ground state or root polygon. It has a bunch of positive moves out of it into successor states. So there are, each of the blue arcs is a positive move. If you go against it from top to bottom, it's a positive move, and from bottom to top, it will be a negative move, right? Here is the next set of states, and there may be some positive moves into those. You can think of the first one as having length 4, the next, the successor states, as having length 6. And these as having length 8 and so on. But they are arbitrary moves that connect these, some elementary moves you've introduced. Here are ones where there's a neutral move. So the green arc there doesn't change the size. It's a neutral move. And the full connectivity of a diagram may look like this, right? So this one may be a graphical representation of how the elementary move connect your state space. I'm going to sample along a sequence in this graph from the root. So this is a positive move, another positive move, and I write down the probabilities in the left top there. Here I pick a neutral move. It's 1/2 + 1, the probability of doing this, because there are, of course, two positive moves that you could have chosen instead. And in this case, it's 1/3 + 1, because you can invert the neutral move to go back. And this sort of thing you want to implement with pruning and enrichment. So here is the algorithm. You have a start polygon phi zero, it's unique and smallest. Only positive and neutral moves, and you realize some sequences phi zero, phi one, phi two. And think of this as a sequence in this graph only using positive and neutral moves. The probability of a sequence is that. That's what every step, your probability of picking your next state is given by the sum of the positive and neutral move, or neutral atmospheres. And I'm going to assign these weights. So the average weight of sequences ending in a given state tau is just given by that. The weight of the state times the probability of realizing it. Summing over all the sequences, which ends in the state tau. Of course, the sequences start in phi zero, your root state. And so it's given by this product, sum over the product of inverses of the negative moves and your neutral moves. So time reverse the above. So what you now do is you start in the state tau and you step backwards. You do negative moves and neutral moves instead. Because you have an irreducible set of elementary moves, you have to enter in the root state. Right? So this is the probability sequence entering the state phi zero, your root state, that has to be one, since phi zero is unique. Comparison to forward stepping proves that the average weight I've computed on the top there must be equal to one. Compute the weight of sequences ending in a state of length n. Just means you sum over all the states tau of length n. So you do that, and you do your little bit of algebra, and you see that gives you the number of polygons. So this is the Gaum counting theorem, and it's a generalization of the Rosenbluth counting theorem. For arbitrary sets of elementary moves, you don't have to do polygons, you can do anything else, right? It always works. Because you only give, well, there are infinite series which go back and forth along neutral moves. Right? So they are conceivable. Yeah. My apologies. It includes all those, yeah. So that sum is a series, it's an infinite series, yeah. So you can use other elementary moves. So here is one where you pick two vertices in your polygon and you expand them into edges. And of course, the inverse of this move is just to contract those two edges, right? Or you could have picked an edge and a vertex and contract one and expand the other. Here is one for walks, right? So I pick that edge, that vertex in the walk, expand it into an edge, or I go back, I contract edges in the walk. This I've implemented with the Gaum algorithm, and this is sort of sampling you see. Again, it's done with pruning and enrichment, so whenever there's a high weight state, it duplicates it, it multiplies it. But what you see is the graphics is a bit poor. My laptop, the graphics card, it seems it's not that good. But what you should look at is that there's quite a bit of pruning going on and backtracking. That backtracking and pruning is always in the search to find states of high weight which it can enrich. Right? And these stable states you see are those which are being enriched. Of course, you don't have to do walks. You can do Ising models, right? So here, I have a 2x2 Ising model by way of illustration. I'm going to think of the ground state of the Ising model, my state phi zero, as all spins down, so all zeros. And every time you flip a spin up from down to up, that's a positive move. And a spin from up to down, that would be a negative move, right? So you pick your Ising model, you pick one of those four spins, and you flip it. And of course, when you flip it, these statistics, A plus and A minus, change. You know, there are three left where you can do a move, and one where you can go back. And you pick another one, and you do this, and you keep on doing this. There are no neutral moves here. And eventually, you get to the state where all the spins are up, and that's your end state. This is one possible sequence, and there are many like it, which have the sequence of energies 0, 2, 2, 2, 0. Here's another one where you get a four in the middle, just by way of illustration that you have. And of course, the number of sequences you have it is n squared factorial. Right? That is the number of choices that you can create the sequences. So you can implement this here with pruning and enrichment. So here you have an Ising model, and the red spins are all down, and the blue spins are up. So So what happens is that it flips things up looking for states of high weight as it does the sampling. You can see this state is being enriched. Right? It's a state of high weight. There's a cluster there in the middle which it likes. And so it's busy enriching it, but eventually it will fall out of it, and then you know it will fluctuate quite badly. So if we just wait, so here it has moved out of this, and it's fluctuating along the sequences from the ground state, the zero state, to the top state, which is all blue. And so, for example, so it almost gets to the end there, but of course it's going to keep on backtracking, and as it completes each sequence, it will start a new one in the all red state. And so here I, for example, did the three-state POTS model, and this is its magnetization. So the axis here on the left, beta, is the temperature axis, or conjugate to temperature. H is a magnetic field, which is coupled to the zero color in this model. And you can see that the high temperature phase is towards you, so in the front, and the low temperature phase is in the back. Right? You can clearly see the critical line where the magnetization is either up or down, or zero or not zero. Here is a problem which is much harder, knotted polygons. So the problem with knotted polygons is that they don't have a unique ground state. Right? So when I knot a polygon like this, here is a polygon of knot type 3-1, a trefoil knot. Its ground state is not unique. There are many different conformations. In fact, there are exactly 3,328 minimal state, minimal length conformations of this knot in the cubic lattice. So you can't do this on a model like this, and so you need a new algorithm. And so here is how you can generalize this kind of sampling in a way which will allow you to sample these polygons. So you're going to generalize the GAM sampling by changing your transition probabilities. So the probabilities whereby you do a positive, a neutral, or a negative move. So this would be, I'm going to introduce, I want to point this out, a set of parameters, beta, these betas. And this is a set of parameters which you introduce into your sampling, and you can pick them freely. Right? You can choose them, for example, to have a flat histogram sampling, where you sample each state with about the same probability. Right? You can tune this algorithm to give that to you. So here's your positive move. And then the neutral and negative moves are given by similar probabilities. And you implement this with these weights. I won't tell you how to get these weights. The calculation is a bit more involved than it was for GAM sampling. But we have a theorem. And the theorem says that if you do this, then the ratio of average weights at different lengths is equal to the ratio of the number of states. So Pn over Pm is equal to the ratio of the weights at lengths n and m. And so if you compute these estimated weights and you take the ratios, you can get approximate values for Pn. And so in this way, this algorithm is truly an approximate enumeration algorithm. You don't have to implement this with pruning and enrichment, because you can tune the beta such that you achieve the desired outcome, that all your states are sampled with the same weight. In a way, what this allows you to do is to sample into the tails of the distribution over your state space and to get good statistics on those, right? That is the hard thing to do usually in the proper style Monte Carlo. So here is the implementation of it. All I want you to see here is that this polygon does not shrink to zero or to the unit square ever. It should eventually if you wait long enough, but what it does is it's essentially a random walk on the length between 4 and, I think in this case, I picked 200 or so, and it will do a random walk between 4 and 200 in length almost uniformly in that interval. And here's the knot table. So you can pick a knotted polygon to be any of the blue ones. The colored ones are links. I'm just going to look at two in this particular talk. We've done more. So this is the unknot. This is the trefoil, and that's the figure eight knot. So the first three in that first row, the simplest of knots. Right? So the unknot is the simplest knot, the trefoil is the next one, the first non-trivial knot, and then the figure eight knot. So here's the trefoil. This is a minimal embedding of it in the cubic lattice. And I'm going to define this number, Pn31. to be the number of polygons of length n, which have this knot type, right? Keep in mind that this knot is chiral, right? So there's a left-hand version and a right-hand version. It's not equal to its mirror image. When I say PN31, I only mean left-handed ones, right? So forget about the right-handed ones. They are really two distinct knot types. Here's the figure eight, so an embedding of the figure eight. And PN41, I want you to remember, is the number of figure eight polygons of length n. So some stuff to know. So this is a theorem, by the way. So at 24 edges, the number of distinct trefoils is 3,328. So this is exactly known. I can tell you how it's proven. I didn't do it. Someone sat down and did a case analysis. There are 75 cases. And he enumerated them all and then counted them one by one by hand and then verified by computer. But the data you get from the algorithm is something like this, right? So at 26, there's roughly 280,000. By the time you get to P500, you can see there's about 10 to the 324. I'm pretty sure about the 10 to the 324, that order of magnitude. I'm not so sure about the 3, but the 3.09. So let us look at this. Pn of k, number of polygons of knot type k and length n. If you do some scaling arguments on it, you see they should have this kind of asymptotic behavior. So it is some kind of exponential growth again, and then some power law correction, where alpha is what we normally call the specific heat exponent or the entropic exponents of polygons. But nk is the number of prime components in your knot. So for every prime component in your knot, that entropic exponent changes by one unit. So for every prime component you have, increment n by one. So for the trefoil, nk is one, right? Because it's a prime knot. For other knots, which are compound knots, it would be two or three. It would just enumerate the number of components. So you can look at this ratio. You take the ratio of trefoil knots to figure eight knots. It should be about that. In fact, it's equal to that amplitude ratio, right? So you get A31 over A41 as n goes to infinity. And this amplitude ratio is a measure of how much more frequent one knot type occurs than another, what the probability is of it occurring. So here is a plot done with this algorithm. I have plotted the log of PN31 over PN41 on the vertical axis against 1 over n. So n goes to infinity goes towards the left. And what you want is that y-intercept. And so asymptotically, you see that if you have a random string, a self-avoiding string, so it's self-interacting, then for every one figure eight, you should see around 25 trefoils, like 25 times more frequent. This is probably universal. It's a universal number. So we've done simulations on the FCC and BCC lattice to see if we get the same, and we get the same. Bayesian Orlandini, two Italians did a calculation where they came from the opposite end. They simulated polygons of lengths, hundreds of thousands of edges, and got about the same. Right? So it is in this vicinity. It's a hard number to calculate, so I don't apologize for that spread, 22 to 27. You will need very good computers and a huge amount of time, CPU time, to beat this down. Anyhow, so let me return to the beginning. Thompson's F group. So have you made up your minds? We can have a vote, if you wish. Who thinks it's amenable? So let us see what we can do with this. So what you want to do is you want to do Monte Carlo on this group. Right? So you have the words in the group, and you want to make changes to them in a Monte Carlo fashion in order to count these trivial words and then to estimate the rate of exponential growth. That is the game. So here's a trivial word. This is a trivial word in the F group. Right? So one thing you can do with it is you can conjugate it. Right? You conjugate it with a generator G, and that will give you another trivial word. So if the word on the left is trivial, then the word on the right is definitely trivial as well. And of course, you don't have to go back in this case. You don't have to invert this move because conjugating the one on the right-hand side of G inverse just gives you back the beginning. That's not enough, though. If you do only conjugation, you can very quickly show that you can't get all the trivial words. Your state space is not connected. It's not, the algorithm wouldn't be irreducible. To make it reducible, you need another move, an elementary move, which I will call a left insertion. This is roughly how it works. You take a relator. So you have a bunch of relators on this group. You pick one of them. You may be conjugating the relator itself before you do this, but you pick a relator. You pick a trivial word. Here is your trivial word. You choose a place where you're going to insert it. You insert it there, right? And you get a new trivial word, but this is not really reduced. Here in blue, I've indicated the A minus followed by an A plus. This could have happened on the right sentence as well, right? It could happen on either side. If it's on the left hand side, then you just cancel it. You just really reduce it. That's called the left cancellation. And if you do that left cancellation, you get a new trivial word. So this is a completely valid move, and you can easily show it's reversible. If that left cancellation happens on the right-hand side, then you reject this move. I won't tell you why, but if you don't do that, your algorithm gets the wrong statistic. You get the wrong distribution. So when you do this, this is your updated word. So you have two elementary moves, two kinds, and you have to mix them, right? So you either do a conjugation, and with default, you do a left insertion. They're somewhat like the BFACF moves in the sense that you can think of these as strings, as paths, lattice paths, and what you're doing is you're inserting pieces into it or deleting pieces in it, right? Making new ones. So you can prove this is uniquely reversible and irreducible on the state space of the trivial word. So if you look at only trivial words, you can prove that this creates a connected graph, essentially on which you can do random walks. In this case, I'm just going to implement the droplet style. I can do, and we are busy doing it, GAM on this, for example, to get much better counts of the words, but I'm interested at this point in the rate of growth of the number of trivial words of length n. So I'm interested at where the singularity in the generating function is on the x-axis. Right? And I said, if it's at the third, then this group is amenable. If it's not at the third, then it's not amenable. Right? So it's an if and only if theorem that we have from Giger, Chuck, and Cohen. So here's the average length of the words. I have set up a Boltzmann distribution on Sn. So beta to the n is my Boltzmann weight. If you want to compute the average length of words at parameter beta, the value of parameter beta, you get this. You just have to compute this. And the algorithm, of course, the metropolis sampling will give you this, an estimate of this directly. You just compute the average of the words that you see in your Markov chain. So this required quite a bit of computing. So we used the multiple Markov chains in implementation. So 80 chains, some trillions of iterations. You get this. And so I hope this answers the mathematician's question. So my colleagues, the people who work on this problem, that at least when they try to prove whether it's amenable or not amenable, that they pick the right theorem to prove, right? Of course, they will need to either it is or it is not. And so at least a number of people have been trying to prove that it is not, which it isn't. And I'll finish there. Thank you.
Okay, I guess we can let the students, if there's any, ask questions first.
So back in the good old days of 486s when I was growing up, there used to be this little program written in Fortran 77 that would draw at random little valid mazes that you had to work your way through, and the maze had to like never get you trapped. Do those maze drawing algorithms have any relationship to the random walk ones you were talking about?
Yeah, I could have prompted that question. If you look at my website, you'll see a big maze on it. It's about 1,000 by 1,000. If you think very hard, you can get out from the middle. The way I make this is, so what is a maze, first of all? A maze is a spanning tree. So if you think of a big piece of these square letters, and you draw a spanning tree on it, it is a maze, right? That's what a maze is. You just have to make sure that at the boundary you satisfy some condition of closure. And so you can sample spanning trees by metropolis sampling. So what you do is here is one very simple algorithm is you have your spanning tree, you pick an edge in it and you delete the edge. That disconnects it into two pieces. And now you have to find a way of putting back that edge in an efficient way. You can just do it by rejection. That's okay, but this can take you a bit long. But for the most part, you may have to use some specialized data structures in order to put it back efficiently. And if you do this, then you can get a new maze from your old maze. Now, I've written a program like that, distant past, maybe 20 years ago, in spare time, just because I like to make mazes like this, and it was a good exercise in Monte Carlo. And I can make lots of mazes for you if you want to. I still have it somewhere. It's an old C program. But it's a good question. But by the way, mazes are of course, these spanning trees are of interest, because if you look at the Green's function of the square lattice, for example, that is a class of spanning trees. Right? So you get spanning trees out of that, for example. So there are reasons why you would want to do this. I've never done it or published anything in this, but it's a truly interesting problem.
And how many spanning trees are there as a function of the size of the square?
Well, the Grove expansion, right?
Okay.
That's a theorem, so it's known. And it has been done on a variety of different lattices. We know there that the number of mazes will grow exponentially for most lattices. Right? If it's not a lattice, then perhaps it is a different story. If you look at spanning trees on the complete graph, so that grows super exponential.
So I guess I open the floor to questions from non-students, since I asked one myself. Any other questions? No? Then let's thank Books again.
Thank you.